Hi there, I'm Ben Morton and welcome back to the podcast. In this episode, episode number 8, I'm interviewing Andy Long, who is the CEO of Pentland Brands. As Andy says himself in the opening few minutes of our conversation, you've probably not heard of Pentland, but you'll almost certainly have heard of at least one of their brands, which include Speedo, Berghaus, Canterbury of New Zealand, and Endura Cycling Wear, to name just a few. In this episode, we dig into what it takes to become the first non-family CEO of a family-run business, and how to successfully transition to leading those people who used to be your peers. We also explore authenticity, humility, and servant leadership once again, which are all emerging as really strong themes amongst all of the leaders I've interviewed on your behalf. And on top of all of that, Andy also talks to us about the importance of managing your energy so that you are ready for those high impact leadership moments when they arise, and the need to be appropriately selfish while still being of service to those that you lead. So without any further delay, please enjoy my conversation with Andy Long. Well, hello, Andy, and welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Ben.
Andy, can I just ask you to kick off by telling us all what you're doing currently, what the role is now, and a little bit about the career journey that got you to where you are, please?
Of course. So my role at the moment is CEO of a business called Pentland Brands. A lot of people haven't heard of Pentland Brands, but most people are aware of at least one of our brands. We own, among others, Speedo, Berghaus, Canterbury, LS, and more recently added Endura, a cycling brand, to our portfolio. So mostly in that sports and active position. I started my career in a very different place, actually. I started as a finance trainee at Procter & Gamble, and my very first role as a graduate for them was on colour cosmetics. And as a rugby player going into the world of colour cosmetics, I think the first few weeks were spent figuring out what the products were by talking to every female friend and colleague to try and get my head around that. Given that after a year working in the head office, I then spent a couple of years in the factory that was making them, the conversation then changed to the other way around over the years, as I was able to critique various pieces of makeup friends were using along the way. I spent 8 years at P&G. The last job I did there was my first sort of significant leadership job, setting up a shared service operation in the northeast of England, and then decided that the time was right to move on and went and spent 4 years at Boots in Nottingham, initially as a finance director for one of their operating divisions, and then finished up running the SAP program, sort of transforming the systems platform of the business. From there, I joined Speedo, part of the current family I'm in, and I've now been with them 15 years, initially as finance director and then running Speedo, and then took on the group CFO role a few years back, and through chief operating officer to CEO. And one of the things that's really interesting about doing the role is I'm the first non-family CEO in the business. So I actually took over from three generations of the owners. And obviously, it was a big move for them to, at that point, appoint an external CEO. So, has definitely played a factor in the way the role has worked out for me.
Well, it's quite some journey. I'm definitely going to try and come back to that point around being the first non-family CEO, because I'm sure there's some learnings there that other people who are finding themselves going into a similar position in the future could learn from. So I'd expect that brought some challenges as well as opportunities. Kind of the next question I'd love to ask, like, how has that entire journey shaped you as a leader, do you think? And what are some of the main leadership lessons you've learned and picked up along the way?
I think inevitably, you know, that's been so many different experiences, so many different roles, worked with so many different people. Everything I've done has shaped me a little bit along the way. Procter & Gamble is known, and rightfully so, as a company that is a great starting point for business leaders. That was absolutely my experience. And the peer group that I found myself in was a combination of people with different starting point experience. A lot of graduates like myself, a lot of people who've already pursued some form of professional career. They hire quite a few from the military. So, you know, it was a really good peer group to learn from. And then they promote from within. So the opportunities and the expectations were there. I think if I was to try and sum up maybe the big learnings along the way, though, it's about a combination of authenticity and patience. Because we hear a lot about, you know, what are you going to achieve? What does the first 100 days look like? What's the big plan? But ultimately, leadership is about people rather than the plan. And the plan is only as good as the extent to which the people that you're relied on to make stuff happen can get it, can feel excited by it, and see it as the opportunity. Part of that comes from trust, which is where the authenticity bit comes in, about, you know, learning to be comfortable being yourself and then finding a way for that to be effective. And then the patience bit is recognizing that actually that there's something about always having aspirations beyond the bar that you're currently able to aim for, but recognizing those moments, recognizing the moments when you can go further. And so, you know, as I look back over my career, there's a lot of frustrations about things that I feel like I could have moved faster, should have moved faster, would have ideally gone faster at the time. But actually, it was all about recognizing when the opportunity came along and not blowing it by going too hard and losing people along the way, because leadership has to be about more than you, has to be about the collective effort. And that's where those two things really come together.
Great. And I just want to go back slightly. I heard you mention, I think you used the word sort of learning to be yourself when you were talking about authenticity, which is really interesting, because that's already, it's a real theme I'm noticing amongst all of the MD CEOs that I've had on the show so far. Like at what point did that sort of, was that a realization that come to you almost, that sort of up until a certain point you'd been wearing a bit of a mask perhaps, or pretending to be somebody you wasn't? And if so, is that something kind of, if you could go back, you would change and be more of your real self earlier? Or do you think that's just a natural journey that we go through when the time is right?
So I think it probably is a bit of a natural journey. I think I'd probably break it down in three phases. And I was really lucky in the way that P&G developed leaders, by kind of throwing you in at the deep end. But what it meant was I took on my first substantial leadership position in an organization I'd grown up in. And so, you know, as we all do when we start somewhere and we're young, you make friends, you go out, you go drinking together, you do all those social things that you do with colleagues. And in that first phase, you are unquestionably thinking, right, what's the corporate approach? You know, how do I want to come across here? And there's a settling down period. And then I think you find a level of comfort, you know, with yourself, with your peer group. And, yeah, hopefully most of us find a level of equilibrium that says, I understand the right way to be myself in this environment. And I think it's important, and I think it's what allows, you know, all of us to then find the energy to do other things. When that really got tested, though, was that transition into sort of a fairly big leadership role, where I suddenly found myself senior to some of these people I'd been out and had fun with over the years. And at that point, you've got to, again, find another phase, which is, how can I still be that person? How can I still be true to that person that they've been out and had a good laugh with, or, you know, whatever we've shared over the years, while at the same time doing what I need to do as a leader? And I think, you know, I was really lucky in the sense of being forced to manage that transition while I was still in my 20s. And at a point at which kind of, you know, everything was exciting, everything was an opportunity and could still go at it. But I can still remember to this day that realization of being sat in a room with a bunch of colleagues talking through a problem and then realizing I was the one who was going to actually have to make the call, because that was, you know, the position I'd now been put in. And I think probably a recurring theme that might come out of this is a key bit of leadership is just recognizing those moments and
right.
You know,
yeah.
Knowing that that's what you need to do and that's what you're there for.
Yeah. And was there anything in particular that you did differently or anything you changed or anything you stopped doing in those moments where you suddenly went from being kind of somebody's or people's peer and colleague to being in a more senior leadership position to them? Because I think that's something people struggle with a lot. I certainly get asked questions in my role around that a lot. And I think that's true whether you're going from sort of a functional expert or a doer, if you like, to suddenly being a first line team leader. It crops up a lot. So I'm curious, are there any particular tactics or things you did to manage that?
Yeah, I think there's probably an important sensitivity about, you know, when's the right time to step away. So I use the sort of example of socializing with colleagues that you then end up responsible for. I don't think any of us want to work with the person who gets promoted and then you never see them again. They never come out for a drink. They're too precious for you. But it's about recognizing that there is going to be a gradual distancing. There are going to be those difficult moments. And just, I think, being sensitive to it. If I look back now from a sort of more established senior position and obviously of a certain age as well, it shows itself in the simplest way that says, when it comes around to the Christmas party, it's actually good for the organisation to see me at the Christmas party. And, you know, people want to know that you're human. People want to know that you've had good fun. People want to be said thank you to for everything they've done that year and buy them a drink. You know, that's all brilliant. And then actually there's a point as well where you want to, you don't want the bosses there. You want to be left alone to have fun. And I think, you know, that's the end point. And obviously I wasn't age 28 thinking it through going, by the time I'm in my late 40s, that's success. But, you know, there is that gradual dawning realization of the fact that, you know, these relationships are going to be different. And what's really important is that ability to, you know, still engage with people and for them still to believe in everything they saw and liked of you before. But it's no longer about popularity. It's about, you know, trust and strong and effective working relationships.
Yeah, that's amazing. And did you have any situations where some of those people who were once your peer sort of struggled with you suddenly becoming the boss in inverted commas?
Only in sort of fringe senses. So, you know, I think on the whole, it was well managed by everybody and hopefully that includes me. But the odd sort of knock doesn't hurt in that sense because the odd comment, the odd knock is actually just a helpful reminder that this stuff matters and do it right and do it well. I think what I found though was by being prepared to take on that responsibility of leader, it actually quite quickly resolves itself. And you know, if these are good people you're working with, then they actually recognize that that's something you're doing for them. P&G had a really simple leadership model of envision, energize, and enable. And the reality is you sort of hear and see a lot about the envision and energize side of leadership, you know, the leaders as the big visible characters. In reality, 90% of the work should be the enabling stuff, which is what are you doing as the leader to make everything work as well as possible? I went through this again when I moved into my current role, that there is no excuse when you get promoted somewhere within to not recognize what it takes to make it work better and be visibly committed to that, because that's going to be the key to collective success.
Yeah, amazing. And that's quite a nice segue, Andy, into sort of the next question I was going to ask. And you've answered part of this already, but I was just wondering, are there any particular, other than maybe sort of envision, energize and enable, are there any particular models, frameworks or principles that you use as a leader and have sort of been core to your leadership style?
That really forms the backbone. I've already mentioned authenticity, and one of the books that was doing the rounds actually when I was at P&G was this idea of the servant leader, and you know, making sure that first and foremost you come at leadership as a responsibility, and a responsibility to the people that you're leading, rather than it being about you and about your ego. And you know, I've got to be honest, that lends itself well to my personality, and we're all suckers for stuff that sort of, you know, sort of speaks to and provides a structure around what we see and believe. But actually, what P&G did, and they did this on a lot of stuff by having three E's, was just kept it really, really simple. And I found it's a model that sustains. And as I've worked with other models over the years, and yes, there's been plenty. It's always been a refinement of that essential way through, rather than anything more complex or sophisticated.
Okay, brilliant. Like with that in mind, do you mind having a go at sort of giving us the 5-minute lesson on the three E's then? That'd be fantastic.
Yeah, of course. And I think, you know, it's quite straightforward in the sense of, you know, everything you hear about the leader as the strategist, everything you hear about the leader being sort of the symbol and the follower, the creator of followers, really comes from this concept of envision. You've got to be the one who sees over the next hill, which is obviously quite an interesting thing to reflect on in the light of the coronavirus pandemic that, yeah, caught most of us wrong-footed this year. And you know, even in that situation, it's about, right, how do we then create a new definition of success? How do we create a new bar for ourselves so that there's always something that says we are collectively setting out to achieve this? The energize piece is really about then recognizing that the role the leader has is to bring people together and to give energy. And it really can be quite tiring at times, actually, especially when things are challenging, to say, you know, this is why it's right, this is why it matters. Let's make it real. I visit multiple sites around the world, and there's really two things always that I try and work through. The first one is, what is it that you need to be doing to help us achieve our goals? And the second thing is, thank you for what you have done already that's helped us achieve the goals we've already had. So, you know, at every location around the world, what is it that team are doing that's making a difference? Because that's not necessarily visible on a day-to-day basis to people. I remember years ago on one of my leadership development courses, coming across this quote of a stonemason being asked what he was doing, and one says, you know, I'm putting this brick on top of this brick, and the other one says, I'm building a cathedral. And yeah, I'm sure you've heard it, but yeah, you know, it's a really simple way to think about, you know, all of us ultimately are putting one brick on top of another, whatever it is we're doing in our roles. How do you then, as leader, create the energy that comes from a collective effort to build a cathedral? And that's absolutely critical. The bit that I've already reflected on that I think is then where an awful lot of the work goes in is this enabling piece. And we've been, in my current role, we've been through some pretty painful transitions in terms of ways of working and, you know, how we've needed to set up differently to respond to market changes and stuff. And it's been a real back to basics for me, because the role I've had to play, the most effective role I've been able to play in many cases, has been to go back into teams on the front line and just say, right, what's working, what's not working? What have you tried? What's the insight on why that's a problem? And how can I then, as CEO, unlock the organization to make some of this work? And it can sometimes be the most challenging parts of leadership, and it can sometimes be the most rewarding parts of leadership, because it's where you can really see the difference that you're making. But it was really drilled into me early on in my career. And I remember working with several people at P&G who really, really got that. And every interaction would be, how can I make you more effective in doing your role? And if you think about it, you know, if every leader in any organization, if our national leaders in a time of crisis were thinking about, right, my job first and foremost is to make this organization deliver at the utmost of its capacity, then wow, how powerful we could all be.
Yeah, and I mean, that's such a powerful viewpoint and way of flipping it. And so I guess it comes back to the concept of servant leadership, right? Sort of my role is, how can I help you be more effective? How can I help you do what you need to do for the organization, as opposed to I'm the leader and this is what I need you to do for me, right?
Absolutely. And we've all come across, you know, people who fall in the latter camp. And my reflection would be that in most cases it's effective for a while, or can be effective for a while, and you know, ultimately then runs out. Whereas, you know, I think the former type of leadership, the great thing about that is you're going to leave something that's sustained beyond you. And none of us are without ego. And so, you know, it's actually great to think that there's something that sustains beyond your involvement with it. That's the biggest buzz of all, I think.
Yeah, and Andy, I'd just love to come back to something I heard you mention when you was talking about the energize piece. You said, and it can be challenging and it can be tiring at times when you're sort of giving out that energy and trying to energize the team. How do you, as a CEO, as a leader, how do you manage your energy in those times? And when it is tough and challenging, what sort of fuels you?
I'm actually quite a creature of routine, but I acknowledge that it has to be an ever-changing routine. So, yeah, it's partly about getting the basics right, you know, sleep, eat, exercise, and thinking about, you know, how I do that. And one of the things actually I've realized with age, partly through necessity and partly through experience, is even when I'm traveling, for example, it's right to be appropriately selfish at times. So actually, no, I'm not going to go with that schedule, because that means I'm going to turn up there and I'll have been out for dinner till 11 o'clock the night before, and then you'll need me up at 6 to be in the car. And you know what? If I'm going to give that presentation, I'm better off if I've had an hour in the gym. So therefore, let's move everything. So you know, really looking at how it will all work and saying, can I keep this in balance? And I think any of us can give ourselves a boost. Any of us can work on batteries, on caffeine, whatever for a while. But then there's a point when you crash, and you kind of need to be in control of that point when you crash, because it really can't be at a point where you need to be at maximum impact. One of the things we actually consciously talk about in the business are, what are your high impact moments? What are the moments that are going to make a difference? I used to play rugby, and thinking about it from a sporting point of view, that concept of sort of being match fit so you could go and run out week in, week out, a lot of that is important, because you are just having to sort of go with it and challenging schedules the whole time. But equally, when there was something, you know, when there was a big game that really mattered, you would do something different. You would pull back on some stuff. And so really trying to think about how you fit that into the schedule. All of that said, it's in the context of, and I don't know, yeah, how much this is the way I'm wired or the experience that I had growing up or what have you, but I've been really lucky in always enjoying what I do. So, yeah, there's always that element as well of, yes, it's satisfying and I can get a buzz out of believing I've made a difference.
Yeah, I love that sort of reasonably selfish point, it links really strongly sort of one of my guiding principles when it comes to leadership. It links to the servant leadership piece is very much that leadership is about others, but it starts with us. And for me, that's really about the airplane oxygen mask analogy. So
absolutely.
Your mask will drop. Please put yours on before helping anybody else. Because if we're not fit and fueled and got our kind of energy right, then we can't be of service to those that we lead. And we certainly can't lead our teams and organizations from our sick bed, right?
So exactly. I mean, I was working with somebody coming into this crisis, a guy I've done work with as a coach for over 10 years now, who's got a military background. And the coronavirus crisis has probably drawn the biggest parallels we've ever had between the business world and that military experience that I know you have as well. And it started with, right, you know, is everybody you're relying on to make decisions A, healthy, B, getting enough sleep, C, eating? Because you personally, and then in your sort of line of command, because it really did need to be command for the first few weeks, if they're not in that situation, then just stand them down. Because you can't afford to be managing through a situation like this without knowing that they're looking after themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Amazing. I hadn't planned on asking you this, Andy, but seeing as you mentioned it at the start, I'd love just to spend a few minutes on this sort of becoming the CEO of the first non-family member of the business. So for anybody who might be finding themselves in a similar situation in the future, are there any key learnings you've picked up there or any kind of really significant bits of advice you would offer up?
I think the really important advice to anybody in this situation would be, if you're being appointed as an outside CEO for the first time, do they really mean it? I.e., is the role that you're being offered a CEO role as you would understand it? I'm going to then very quickly say, and my biggest challenge or risk of screwing it up in my first few months was because I was an internal appointment, I don't think I initially switched on to how much they really did mean it.
Right, okay.
So I'd gone from being COO to CEO, and I think the first 3 months, I was still playing the same role. I was going through the motions. I was doing all that sort of 3E stuff and, you know, setting my vision and what have you. But I don't think I really believed myself that this transition was real. And I had a sit down with my my boss, who was also my predecessor, you know, third generation of this family, and had become my chair after about 3 months, and said, you know, I think that I need to be doing this, and I've realised I'm sort of holding back. And he just smiled at me and said, yeah, that's why we've appointed you.
Right.
Because, you know, that's what we were hoping you would do. And I was like, crikey, you know, I almost missed that. And so I think, you know, both come out of that. I think if you've grown up internally, it's worth just being clear on the level of reset that does require. And what was strange for me was I'd been on the top team by the time I got appointed for 6 or 7 years. And so it was all familiar. And yet the CEO job was still such a huge transition. You know, that whole feeling of taking on a leadership role again. And then on the flip side, when I've seen it not work well in private businesses, it's, you know, is it really a CEO that somebody wants? Because I think particularly if you're being hired in from outside without that experience, it's so important to test as much as you possibly can what are the parameters I'm being given. As I say, I sort of learned that the wrong way around, but, you know, it's probably the best advice I could offer.
Yeah, that reminds me, telling the story there about that conversation with your predecessor and chairman reminds me of the book, the First 90 Days. I'm sure you've probably read it. Yeah. So many people have, where one of his principles is promote yourself, but not as in go around the business sort of promoting yourself. This is who I am. Aren't I great? But pick a moment in time where you actually make the transition mentally in your head from old role to new role and really significantly market, which is kind of what I heard you talking about.
Yeah, and there are some contradictions and some challenges. So I talked earlier about being appropriately selfish and how you look after yourself. And that first time you sort of get given a schedule and go, actually, no, you know what? That doesn't work for me. And where does this fit between my servant leadership if I want everybody to feel okay and that I'm doing the right thing by them and my, you know what, I'm the CEO and I need to make sure I turn up right. And just sort of spotting those things and navigating them with a degree of sensitivity is quite important. Because, you know, we're each going to do things our own way. We're each going to have our own tempo. And there's a balance there, isn't there, between saying to somebody, no, I don't want to do it like that, and not coming across as if that's just you sort of throwing your weight around because they've now given you a bigger title, but actually making sure that it's done with the right motives and you know, because that's how they get the best out of you. So in those first few months, I probably spent quite a bit of time in conversations with people to say, well, you know, how's that going to work? And let's think about that. That I think was ultimately time well invested and, you know, these days can be covered off on an email.
Yeah, absolutely. Andy, conscious of time, so I always like to finish up with a few slightly more quickfire questions. So what are sort of the one or two or some of the books from a leadership, personal development perspective that have had the biggest impact on you?
So I read quite a lot across a really diverse range of subjects. I was thinking about this coming in. I think from a business point of view, the one book that has really stayed with me over the years has been Jim Collins' Good to Great, because it really dissects it in a great storytelling way and, you know, looks at a number of factors in businesses that have been successful in a sustainable way that really breaks it down. In terms of other areas, and without sort of coming up with specific books, I enjoy reading history. I enjoy reading biographies and really understanding what makes people who've done amazing stuff tick. So, you know, whether that was Mandela's biography, the most recent biography I read was actually the one of Clem Attlee. And it's just such a fascinating generation to hear, you know, these people who, in his instance, had a life and death leadership in the First War, helping run the country during the Second World War, and then, you know, the political tidal wave that unleashed after 19, you know, just understanding, to your point earlier about how do you keep that energy and what have you, just understanding how people get through those kinds of things, I find a fascinating reference point and always take something from it.
Right. And what are you reading, learning about right now?
So I'm currently halfway through Matthew Syed's Rebel Ideas book, which is probably quite a good one to be on at the moment, given the real focus on diversity. But that's about understanding the value that diversity in a cognitive sense brings to businesses. And again, he's a really good storyteller. So it's just great examples of stuff that's gone wrong because of groupthink, you know, in a very high level summary, which I find really powerful and great to test, you know, stuff I do in work and in life more generally to make sure that there's not blind corners.
Yeah, the groupthink thing is fascinating for me. I'm sure you do as well, but I come across it so often when you just stop and ask somebody, like, why are you doing that or why are you doing it that way? And the answer that often comes back is, well, that's just the way we do things around here. Well, right, but doesn't it might have been valid once upon a time, but the situation might have changed. So let's test it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I discovered behavioral economics about 15 years ago, and that's another subject I've read up on over the years and can get really excited about. But this whole area of biases and you know, all the biases that we carry with us for you know, often good evolutionary reasons, but then create you know, challenging outcomes. That was actually something I got so excited by. I sort of took back and trained in the business, and I'm still always just pushing. Yeah, we've done unconscious bias training over the last couple of years, and really getting people to think about what are those pitfalls that you fall into, and how can you just be better set up to ask the right questions or seek out the right person. I think it's absolutely something that many businesses suffer from and can be easily resolved, actually.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Final question I've got for you, which is one people are always really interested in. Do you have any particular routines, habits, ways of working that help you sort of structure your days, play at your best, and any that are particularly kind of interesting, quirky, or strange? How do you structure your day to play at your best?
Well, it's interesting because you're asking this in a period when every single routine has been totally blown up. So my when I'm spending time in my normal office in North London, I get up at 5:30 in the morning. I drive in early before the traffic, and I go to the gym so that I hit my desk at about 8 o'clock, having already exercised and worked out. As I sit here today, I don't know if it's ever going to be quite like that again, or if I get back to it. But that's worked for me for the last 10 years. And it's worth saying that, you know, with three kids at home who are getting a bit bigger now, but were very young through that period, what that did was meant that more often or not, I was out quickly at the other end of the day and was home, you know, more recently for tea time, before that for certainly bath time and stories. So I sort of balanced that whole get the best of me in the office, take care of myself a bit, and then get out the other end. The other routine I am absolutely renowned for in terms of working practice is very low tolerance of my email inbox. I can just get a bit obsessive, and if, you know, if too much comes in, I just sort of have to say, right, just give me a moment because I need to just go and offload stuff.
Okay,
and I'm very good at, right, that's just delete, that's just for info file, that needs to be delegated, here's the stuff that I actually need to do stuff with. But I can get a bit obsessive about it, and it's really just about, you know, it's in the same way you clean your windscreen if you were driving and it was getting mucky. You know, I just need to be able to see what's coming in. And if I know that that's okay, then I'm confident I can just go about and do what I need to do, most of which obviously shouldn't be behind a screen. But I have to know it's under control.
Brilliant. I love that clean the windscreen analogy. I might use that myself in the future. Andy, thank you so much for your time and being on the show. There's absolute gold dust in there. I started off scribbling down some notes from what you were saying and then quickly stopped because I wanted to make sure I was giving you my full attention and listening. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot in there that people will take away, learn from, but most importantly, hopefully that they can use and implement. So thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Ben. Absolute pleasure.
So there you have it, folks, my interview with Andy Long of Pentland Brands. In my humble opinion, that episode was packed full of golden nuggets, and hopefully you felt the same way having listened to it. If you did find it useful, as always, it would be incredible if you could share the link to the show via your social media and subscribe via iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And just in case you've missed it and you've not done it, remember to go to www.ben-morton.com/podcast to enter your details and get hold of the fantastic visual summaries that we've created for the first 5 episodes. That's it for episode 8. See you again soon, and lead on, folks.